Okay, so at the risk of, I'm not, this first exercise is not intended to humiliate anyone, but we need to get people who aren't on projects connected. So if you're not on one of the projects that I sent out earlier, there's, I think, six projects that I consider more or less approved at this point, raise your hands. All right, so we have one, two, three. So that's about half the people, because there's still a total of six or seven not on projects. You guys need to get together and figure out a strategy, because by the end of this week, if you're not on projects, I'm going to drop people from the course who are not on projects. And it's already a little bit late. All right, so it's taking forever for my desktop to come up. We are going to start promptly at 12:30.
I know. I had to figure some stuff out.
It's okay. So what did you think of the technical... So what do you think of the websites? Have you looked around at some of the other websites? Yeah. What?
A lot of wind.
A lot of wind. Actually, I was thinking the same thing. You know, being an electrical engineer, I'm feeling kind of out of place. All these wind energy, well, actually, a lot of them do involve electronics, but a lot of wind energy projects. But that's okay. What about technical specifications? That was a little harder than it seemed, right?
Well, yeah, because we're not yet there. So, I don't know. I know our group, we chose one just to have specific numbers. But it's like we're not that deep in the project yet to write that.
Right. You might be able to get away with that excuse in someone else's class, but not mine.
Can I ask you?
Life is all about, engineering life is all about talking about things you haven't done yet. If you haven't figured that out yet, you're going to figure that out before this class is over.
Can I ask you something about,
sure,
our group? About our project?
If it's not too specific to your...
I'm sorry, what?
If it's a general question.
Okay.
If not, we should probably take it offline. The issue with the, there was an issue with the mail alias, but that's been resolved as of a few minutes ago. What was that question? I sent a message which had all the projects listed and their URLs. Okay, they promised me this wouldn't be the case. All right, let me go back. Not you. How many people still cannot read PPTX files from some College of Engineering owned machine? PPTX files. Yeah. So I've been on this warpath to make sure all our machines can read Office 2007 documents. This one can't, I just found out. It can't? I was told all the machines would have that this semester. I'll work on that. Okay, so what I want to talk about today, I want to give you a very real sense of what this course is all about and what are some of the things that I'm going to be looking for in your projects. Even though we have a multidisciplinary course and we have a lot of projects from a lot of different areas, engineering is engineering. There's a sort of a standard process that applies across all fields. And initially, some of you may think it's hard. He's really talking about stuff that's specific to electrical or something, but eventually you're going to learn that you're going to write proposals the same way, whether they're about mechanical engineering, civil engineering, or electrical engineering. You're going to manage and budget and forecast all projects the same way. So in this course, you're going to learn a general engineering process that will, I think, be very valuable to you throughout your careers. And I'll tell you, when I was a student, we didn't have these kinds of courses, so you had to learn all this stuff on the fly in industry. We're saving you about 10 years of your career by teaching you this stuff, because when you hit the ground running in today's world, companies are going to want to know that you're able to budget, manage, schedule projects. You all be doing that within your first year, most likely. That's one of the ways that engineering has changed. So let's begin. So this lecture used to be called the hammer lecture because I talked about my favorite hammers, but I've changed it a little bit this year. But we'll essentially cover the same kind of material. So let me begin by asking a question, simple question, that's really relevant to senior design. Which involves more engineering design, a golf club, say a driver, or an iPod? How many people say iPod? How many people say golf clubs? How many people play golf? Of those ones who said golf club, how many of you actually play golf? Not all of them, okay. So if you do not play golf but selected golf club, raise your hand. Okay, so tell me why a golf club involves more engineering design than an iPod. And I'm assuming you have, some of you may have actually heard this line back in a seminar course last semester. What background are you? ME, CE, or?
CE.
CE, okay, good. Good. So some good multidisciplinary thinking there. What's the most heavily engineered piece of sporting equipment? What? Come on, let's keep it clean. That's a new one. I haven't had that one before. No, seriously, what's the most... It's not that, by the way. What's the most heavily engineered piece of sporting equipment?
Golf club.
What piece of equipment has by far more investment? This is something that boggles my mind, but if you look at the total money invested on a single piece of equipment, I don't know about shoes. Athletic shoes may actually surpass that, but in terms of equipment, like baseball gloves and bats and all these kinds of things, what has the most investment? Golf clubs. Golf clubs are incredibly state-of-the-art, incredibly engineered. Every single, even though it's a relatively simple thing, every single aspect of a golf club has probably millions of hours of engineering design behind it. It's just unbelievable how much time has been spent optimizing golf clubs. And actually, it's a success story because today, golfers do amazing things that were not considered possible. 20, 30 years ago, if you drove a golf ball 250 yards, you would win a driving contest. Today, if you don't drive, I don't know, 500, 600, 700 yards, it's unbelievable how far they drive. You know, you don't even place. I mean, they're driving, a short drive today is like 400 yards. And that's all largely because athletes have gotten a little bit better, but largely because the technology has advanced considerably. Now, what makes an iPod a bad choice for an engineering, for a senior design class?
Expensive to build?
No, actually not that expensive to build. What?
It's like to have more features, to create that end,
No. In fact, quite the opposite. You'll continue to see more and more features put into iPhones. I mean, you've got iPods, iPhones, all these things are like the same now. They're just a chip with a display. Right. So why isn't that excellent? That's absolutely correct. And that's something we're going to get over in the first few weeks of this course. Why isn't that a good senior design project? There's essentially no design to that. It's mostly systems integration. And that's the mentality we're going to try to get you over today with this lecture, is senior design is not about building cool things. There's a place for that. But it's about setting some design constraints and optimizing a design to meet those constraints. And that's what we call the design content. And that's ultimately what I'm going to push you on your projects. And you're going to get tired of this because I'm going to beat on you for 14 weeks. But that's what senior design is all about. There's a lot of really good resources on the web. So there's a lot of good design lectures here. You can read all about all the different design paradigms and things. I want to take you through something a little more focused today and a little more specific to what we're going to do this semester. But if you haven't read about basic principles to engineering design, there are several very good lectures here that will introduce you to all the different design paradigms and things like that. So let's begin with a motivational statement. The scientist seeks to understand what is. The engineer seeks to create what never was. This was attributed to Theodore von Karman, who is considered the father of supersonic flight. He was born in 1881, died in 1963. I always laugh when they say, you read history books and they say things like so-and-so discovered the Grand Canyon. Right? I mean, what did that really take? Like, you fall off the edge? I mean, you walk up to this thing, it's there, it's not so hard to find, it's like hundreds of miles big. You know, but they get into history books for that, right? Well, that's sort of basic science. It's important, and people are continually discovering new things, but they're essentially finding these things. They exist, and it's just a matter of finding them. What's really neat about engineering is we create things that change the world, things that never existed before, things like iPods or things, just everything around us, and yet we're not really appreciated for it. So that's sort of the role, the challenge of being an engineer is we do all these really great things, we change the world, we make the world a better place, all those kinds of things, but we're never really appreciated for it. That's tough, but that also means engineers are always going to have a place in the world because we're the ones who make things happen. Now, what we're going to really probe on in this class is the process with which we create this new technology, because that's what's really changed in the last 50 years. In the post-World War II era, money was no object, and you would build something because you thought it was something really cool to build. And you wouldn't really worry about the size, weight, shape, or environmental impact of that thing. Most of the time, it was just, could it do something? So we built big cars, we built big trucks, we built big missiles and airplanes and all these things. But that's not the way the world is today. So what is senior design not about? How many of you sat in a group sometime over the last few months trying to think up some really cool project? Come on, be honest. A number of you, right? Were those meetings productive? Did you end up choosing that project? Did anything productive come out of that meeting other than maybe a few drinks or, something social? Senior design is not about creating a unique project concept. I've gone through that phase previously at my former institution. Students get really stressed out because they think they have to create something, they have to invent something. That's not what senior design is about. It's not about inventing a new gadget that's never been done before. That's a hard thing. Things like iPods, some of the most creative people in the world spent years perfecting that concept before it was ever built. You don't just sit down in senior design and build an iPod and invent an iPod. Now, that's not to say you're not all creative, and that's not to say you all won't have great things to do in your careers, but we're not putting that additional stress on you in senior design. You could actually choose to build something that already exists. That's perfectly fine with me. And it's not about doing something that has never been done before. It's hard to do something that's never been done before. It's hard, especially when you're learning how to be an engineer. So that's not what senior design is about. Senior design is about translating customer needs into quantitative design constraints. This is probably the biggest thing that I'm going to stress this semester. Problems, you rarely in engineering get a chance to solve a problem just because you're intellectually interested in that problem. What problems are you going to end up solving in engineering? What?
The employer's problem.
And where does the employer get the problem from? The customer. So very early in your careers, you're going to get to meet the dreaded marketing people. And you're going to hate them like most engineers hate them because they're always out there promising things that you as engineers don't feel are possible to do.
Sorry, I'm late.
But what are your employer's problems? Where do those come from? Customers, right? Most of the products that you'll work on will be driven by customer-defined constraints. Now, does the customer always know what they want? No. So another important part of engineering is actually translating what the customer thinks they want into something that makes engineering sense. And you'll learn about that this semester. Another very important part about senior design is optimizing a design to meet these constraints. Every product you look at, may I borrow your water bottle for a second? Y'all don't think there's a lot of engineering time involved in this, right? Every aspect of this product has been advertised, has been optimized to reduce cost, to increase profit, to meet the customer's needs. And we'll talk about that towards the end of class. We'll go through an example like this. Most of the time, those optimizations are done with computer tools these days. You never actually build this thing until you're really, really sure you know what you need to build. So you'll get a chance to use all these high-powered simulation tools, whether it's 3D modeling tools or electrical circuit tools. All these tools, MATLAB, things like that, allow you to essentially design this and optimize it without ever building it. Why is that necessary? Because the processes for building things today are very complicated. To build a chip with 30 million gates, that's not trivial. To build some really articulated shape that, you know, it's amazing. You look at even, I'm a big fan of the dollar store. I just love looking at what you can sell for a dollar in the U.S. Thanks to China mainly. But, you know, you look at these products. Have you looked at these products that people sell for a dollar? And have you ever thought about how much engineering goes into those products? They're custom moldings and shapes and labeling and all this stuff. Well, that's because they have very sophisticated manufacturing processes that can take your 3D designs and turn them into real products. We have, I think, one milling machine here. I think I just saw it yesterday in the shop, in fact. But, you know, we've got machines now where they can take your 3D drawings and build them, even if they're things like ships in a bottle. You can build these things with these 3D printers, as they call them, and things. So computer automated manufacturing is very sophisticated. All of the value added for you as engineers is in the design of the product. When you hear about jobs getting outsourced, those aren't design jobs. Those are the jobs that are heavily automated, the manufacturing jobs typically, and the production jobs. But the design, translating customer ideas or needs into real products, that's where the value added is as engineers. And those jobs are still largely in the U.S. because we have a very good industrial base here. Now, another very important thing. You know, probably one of the most striking examples of this, when the space shuttle blew up, the first one, I think, what, two of them have blown up or something? Who gets the phone call? Well, you know, works its way down, right? The president picks up the phone and calls the head of NASA and says, what the F happened? Now, head of NASA, who does head of NASA call? What? They're going to call some engineer, potentially one of you, who was project manager on that project. You're going to go to your stack of papers and say, well, the contractor, Rockwell or whoever in that case, said that they met their design constraints. So it's not my fault because my project delivered what was said, what was required with the design constraints for that contract. It said if I do this, this, and this, they get their money. Well, when the first shuttle, I think the first one was the one that blew up because the tiles displaced and they, and then it caused a rupture. It compromised the integrity of the heat shields, right? I think that was the first one that blew up in, no, I think the first one that blew up was the gasket, right? The gasket on the fuel tanks, which is an even better example. You know, this is where you start to get into very serious arguments about, did the product actually meet the design constraints? Did the design constraints reflect what's needed for the application? Who's responsible for the design constraints reflecting the needs of the application? That's you as the project manager. Who's responsible for the product meeting those design constraints? That's the developer or the manufacturer or the supplier. The only way these groups communicate, and this is something I learned the hard way, I spent 3 years in the government from 2005 to 2007. I actually had been teaching senior design for quite a while before that, and I was giving the same lecture, preaching about design constraints. I found myself on the other side of the fence. I was a project manager, and contractors were delivering garbage to me. And I had to sit in meetings and argue with them about design constraints. And at one point, I told my friend, I said, you know, this is just like what I used to teach in senior design. We're sitting here arguing about quantitative design constraints. But getting the design constraints right, most of the time when a project fails, it's not that the contractor or the developer did not do what was needed to be done. It's that your design constraints did not adequately reflect the needs of the problem. And that's essentially what happened with the space shuttles. The design and test constraints missed some things, and those things turned out to be fatal. So this is a very large part of senior design. I need to watch time because I can go on forever about this stuff. And then another thing about senior design, particularly senior design one, most of you have probably heard, oh, we just do paperwork in senior design one. Not so, not this semester, because to get all these things right, you're probably going to have to do a bit of prototyping and testing to make sure you know what you're talking about. And I know that's going to vary from discipline to discipline, but we're going to work on that. You don't just start building a skyscraper. You know, you test various key pieces of it in the lab to make sure that your ideas are correct. You build scale models. You do all sorts of simulation, because once you start down the path of actually building that thing, you can't go back. And, you know, you don't want to get the skyscraper 90% done to find out that some of the structures at the base level of that skyscraper are not able to carry the loads properly. So there's a lot of incremental testing and prototyping, and we'll talk about that a little bit today. So key elements in this class, learning how to communicate your ideas to management and to customer. You've heard a lot about communication. This is the semester where you really start putting all that to use. Appreciating the multidisciplinary aspects of engineering design. I was involved years ago in a project where we were trying to fit a board with a lot of chips into a PC back in the days when we had these PCATs and things like that. And it was really interesting because we were trying to make the audio components of this board be really low noise, really high quality audio. But the mechanical engineers kept saying we had to put the processor near the audio interfaces because of the cooling for the board and the layout of the board physically to get it to fit into this form factor. And we kept saying, but that's going to kill the audio quality. And we kept arguing back and forth, and the board actually went out with very bad audio quality because we could never get them to compromise on the amount of isolation that we wanted between the audio and the processor. So, of course, when the board hits the market, people are complaining that, oh, I hear noise in the background on the audio. Well, I can tell you why that was. It was because they wouldn't let us put the audio section where we wanted it to be. But it was a back and forth about cost and space and cooling and all those things. So one of the reasons I want multidisciplinary teams is I want one discipline learning about the constraints that the other disciplines impose on their design. Every design is now an integration of all these constraints. You don't just do your part and throw it over the wall to the next part. Everything is done in an integrated fashion. So today what you will do is you'll pass a simulation of the system, and it'll go through various tools. You'll have a tool that does circuit board layouts. You'll have a tool that does thermal modeling. You'll have a tool that does RF generation and all that. All these different tools that will take the system, and you pass it from group to group in simulation state and work out all these issues. And then finally, understanding how practical constraints such as cost and sustainability influence the design process. When you invent a new product today, what's one of the primary concerns about the product that didn't exist probably 20 years ago?
Environmental impact.
When I was in Japan in 91, I used to go past these little computer shops. Behind those shops, they used to have mountains of old computers. They'd just throw them out the back onto the garbage pile. And those things were creating, you know, toxic waste sites because of all the bad stuff in those computers. When we wanted to build new semiconductor processes that we're going to allow us to run faster and better and bigger and all that stuff. One of the biggest concerns was the manufacturing process for those devices. How many toxic chemicals would need to be used, and how are we going to dispose of those toxic chemicals? And at one point you decide, well, it's just not worth the risk. I can't use that kind of technology because the environmental impact will be so bad. And there's aspects of that in every one of the disciplines in this room. And we'll get a chance to talk about some of those through the semester, but this is very real. Environmental impact of your products is a big driver these days. Okay, so if you have any questions, just jump in. I think a lot of these things are pretty obvious. This is an interesting analysis that I ran across in a nice book on design. In the government, we used to talk about performance, schedule, and cost. But in sort of the real world, where you have to worry about investment, we also talk about risk. These four kind of compete against each other. You can always get good performance. In like I was saying, in the post-World War II era, everything was bigger and better, right? Cars were getting bigger every year. Nobody questioned that. You could always build something that had higher performance. Engines were getting bigger. Engines, state-of-the-art engines in the 60s got like eight miles per gallon. I mean, they were really fast cars. But, 8 miles per gallon. You couldn't build that today. You couldn't get funding to build that engine today. Except for maybe Formula One or something. So you can always drive performance up. That's easy. But what competes against that is cost. You always want to control cost and maximize profitability because ultimately the price something will sell at is a large determinant of how successful that product will be. iPods could have, I think I might have told the story to some of you. iPods, I was at Texas Instruments many years ago when we knew about iPods. We had patents and designs on things like iPods. But they weren't like this. They were like this, which was still portable in those days. One of my new graduate students was telling me the other day, he said, you know, I don't have my laptop with me because it weighs 3 kilograms. It's too heavy. And I said, you've got to be kidding. The first laptop I had weighed about 20 pounds. But I was very happy to lug that thing around, and it cost about $20,000 in 1993. So imagine now it's like $200,000 or something. But I was so proud of this that it was portable. You know, I could pick it up, all 20 pounds of it. But, you know, iPods 30 years ago couldn't be this small. But now at $100 and all this, you know, the market has matured. We'll talk maybe through the semester about Netflix. Netflix was another really interesting model. The business model for Netflix existed many, many years ago, but it took the cost of mastering DVDs to get down so cheap and mailing costs to get to a certain point to make Netflix economically feasible. And, you know, those kinds of things. So cost and performance always fight each other. But schedule and risk are two others that you're going to face this semester. Tell me about risk. Why do companies worry about risk? Or how do companies manage risk? From all standpoints. Yeah, there's what kind of risks? What kind of risks are there? There's legal. You know, you can produce that product and find out later that, you know, I always love the toys when, like, these new toys come out and then some baby happens to eat a piece of the toy and all of a sudden you got this big lawsuit on your hands. I don't know if you're following today the Toyota gas pedal deal. They're in a boatload of trouble over this and they're still making cars with the defective parts. It's going to be a nasty battle. So if you're a company and you're producing one product, and your whole company depends on that one product, how much risk are you willing to take? Well, you know, it's interesting. Startup companies tend to assume a lot of risk, right? Because everything, your eggs are in one basket usually. And some startup companies actually take the high risk, high payoff model, and they figure if they go bankrupt, well, it's not their money anyway. It's some venture capitalist money, so there's no big deal. So startup companies actually take a lot of risk, but then 90% or 95% of all startup companies fail. I think there's some statistic that 95% of restaurants fail within the first 9 months. High risk, high payoff. Bigger companies tend to balance risk. You want some high risk projects, some low risk projects, so that on the average, you're staying in business every year. You're all going to, I think, you know, we're going to spend some time this semester setting design constraints. But if every team meets every one of their design constraints, what conclusion will I draw at the end of the semester? Will I say, oh, gee, I was a really good teacher that semester? I'll consider myself a failure because I let you set design constraints, which were too easy. I would expect 20% or so of the design constraints in this course will not be met by the end of the semester. And I'm okay with that, as long as they were set, you know, reasonably. They were a little bit of we call stretch goals. They were a little bit of a risk, but not too much risk. What about schedule? Tell me about scheduling in the world you're going to go into.
You have to meet deadlines.
Who sets deadlines?
You do.
Well, so that's easy, right? You set deadlines. So you all come to me and say, you know, I will finish my senior design project 4 semesters from now with zero risk. Is that acceptable? No. So you have to always set a balanced scheduling and risk. Now at this stage in your careers, many of you are linear thinkers. So you're going to try to line up your projects so that we do this first, then we do this, then we do this, then we do this. And when you add all that up, you're going to have a very long schedule, but very low risk, because every step is dependent on the previous, and you don't start the next one until the previous one is finished, right? We all feel comfortable doing that. Is that the way projects are done in the real world? No. In the real world, getting product to market quickly is another very important ingredient. And you will see this the minute you get out into industry. We used to take years to design products. Auto companies still take years to design products, and that's a big problem. Electronics companies produce products in months. I was involved in one of the neatest projects I was ever involved in was a project where the customer came to us on Labor Day. You know, September 2nd or 3rd, on Labor Day. And they said, here's this concept for a consumer toy. We want this toy on the shelves when?
Christmas.
Now, what does that mean, first of all? Some of you are thinking, oh, December 25th, right? That means it's got to be on the shelves Black Friday. Fortunately, we didn't have Black Friday back then, but today that means Black Friday, which means it's got to ship probably a few weeks early. So you're talking about 1 month, 1.5 months development time? And it was you all are probably too old to know this product, but it was a doll called Julie. It had speech recognition in it. You could talk to Julie and she would talk back to you. First time it was ever attempted. We didn't even know how we were going to do this. And they said, we want this thing's on the shelves and we want it to sell for $100. And, you know, those days, the processor alone cost thousands of dollars. So we had no idea, but they put a lot of money in front of us. And, you know, they threw out the whole vision of every consumer toy was going to be a smart toy. And, you know, this is the beginning of that. So we did it. And we did it, actually. The doll did hit the shelves that Christmas, but it was a crash development cycle. High risk, very short schedule, but high payoff. So these are all competing things, and we're going to constantly struggle with balancing these things. But you will get involved in all of these this semester. You will lay out schedules. You will do cost analyses. You are going to, of course, do performance. And we'll try to do a little bit of risk mitigation. So what is the design process itself? Probably the most useful thing I can tell you about design is a statement I once heard from a computer programmer, which was probably one of the best statements I've ever heard. This person said, you know, the only good programs I've ever written are the ones I've written 4 or 5 times before. So design is always an iterative process. In fact, we will often go through this process in multiple cycles. If you've ever heard of the concept cyclone diagram, you'll see these concentric circles. But there's not a lot of time this semester to do too many iterations. So we're going to focus on at least one iteration of the entire process. And we're going to try to go through this in the 2 semesters that you'll be in senior design. So it starts with the problem statement, proceeds to design constraints. Then we actually do a design. That doesn't mean we build. That means design. That means paper and pencil or computer. Then we'll set up test specifications, which this design should meet. Then we'll do some simulation to show that this design meets those test specifications. Then that's the test verification. Then you'll actually do a little bit of prototyping to make sure that your assumptions in these models are actually valid in the real world. And once we've done that, now we're feeling pretty good. Hopefully this will be the end of Senior Design 1. Now, it's funny because students always say, oh, Senior Design 2, piece of cake. Just have to build the thing. But what happens when you actually start building it?
Find problems.
You find all sorts of problems that were not covered in your design and simulation. You find out that that MATLAB model was a little bit simplified. It doesn't quite work under the loading conditions you're using in your model, in your actual system, or mechanical engineering models, finite elements type stuff. These are all approximations. So then you get involved in rework. And sometimes you actually iterate through this several times before you get it right, and that's why you have revision 1, revision 2, revision 3. So we're going to spend some time this semester going through each of these pieces. Many of you are going to have engineering jobs that focus on just one of these pieces. Probably 25% of you in this room will be test engineers someday. It's a very big field that we don't often talk a lot about. And your job will be to write test specifications for some product that you didn't build. You'll be in an independent testing organization, making sure that the engineers are delivering what they were supposed to. I think a lot of engineers always think about this stage. This is actually, very few engineers actually do this anymore. Most of the time you just hit a button and the thing's manufactured for you, either through automated manufacturing. Circuit boards, for example. Those of you who are going to build circuit boards in the second semester, we'll just send them out over the internet. You send out your circuit description, the board comes back a couple days later. You can order it fully populated or populate it yourself, but it's all automated. With the milling machines and things, you just hit a button and it builds the 3D model for you out of a block of metal or out of a block of plastic. So, problem. The problem statement is actually, I think, the most critical part of the project, because good projects are easy. They kind of take on a life of their own and everything works out. If you have a really good concept that is really amenable to this process, everything takes care of itself. If you have a project that's very nebulous, you know, you're not quite sure what really you're doing, but you just, you know, want to do something, those projects become problematic because it's hard to pull all this other stuff out. Recognize that a problem exists, develop a concise statement of the problem. How many people think they have concise statements of their problems right now? Be honest. Okay, well, you maybe are being honest. It takes a little bit of time to really understand the essence of your problem. The problems are never quite what you think. Startup companies very often end up selling something that was quite different from what they envisioned when they started the company. So the problem always evolves a little bit. Then we set objectives, and these are often what we'll call design constraints. Study the parameters of the problem and convert them into engineering language you're familiar with. Then we do a literature survey. Very important to understand competing technology. When you're building a product, you need to know what your competitors are doing. In the old days, we used to have labs devoted to this where they would go out and buy one of everything that was related to their product. They'd bring it into the company, completely disassemble it, and reverse engineer it. That used to be fun, actually. But you can no longer reverse engineer technology because so much of it is so custom. I might have talked in the seminar course about chips. A lot of times when you open up a piece of electronics, the chip inside the electronics will have no numbering on it, no identification, purposefully, because the company doesn't want you to know where they got that chip from. So then you start making phone calls, and eventually you find out what company built that chip, because you find some person who's talking probably a little bit too much. And then you hopefully get some information about what that chip is. But even then, you don't really know what software or what custom modifications were put inside of that chip. So you can't really reverse engineer a lot of electronics now. Uh, Then we do an analysis. And this is really a heavy part of the engineering problem. We analyze the problem based on knowledge gained from the literature survey and produce a set of design constraints. That's the most critical thing in senior design from an operational point of view. These 10 design constraints I'll talk about next week. Then we generate the test specs. Then we synthesize a solution. We evaluate the solution. And then we go to our management and say, okay, we think we can build this. Here's the plan. Here's what it's going to cost. Here's how long it's going to take. Here's the resources I need. That's where I want you to be at the end of the first semester. Now, that means in Senior Design 1, some amount of simulation, modeling, or even prototyping is going to have to be done. You can't be really solid without knowing a little bit about how this thing's going to really work. Now, the thing I want to quickly go through an abstract, and then I want to spend a few minutes on an actual exercise where we go through some of this. But so what I want for next Friday are two things. I want a PDF file on your website with your tech spec. I know some of the teams turned that in, some of the teams didn't, but I want documents in general off your website should be available as PDF files. It's also okay to put some people do the doc or you know, like Word and PDF or Excel and PDF, but always make a PDF copy available. And then the second thing I want is an abstract. And I'm very, very much into formulaic writing. So in this course, when I ask for something, I'm going to tell you very specifically what I want it to be. So the abstract will be between 150 and 200 words. Does that mean it can be 200? Let's have a very clear understanding from the beginning. Those of you who had me in my signals course will know a little bit about me this way. Does that mean it can be 201 words? No, I will put it into Word. I will count the words. That's just the way I am. And if it's 201, I'll be very happy. Why?
You don't have to grade it.
Thank you. This is one of the things I think students don't get. When you don't, your job should be make it as hard as possible for me to make me actually have to grade your stuff. When students miss formats, that's wonderful because I don't have to grade it. I can just flunk them for missing the format. If you don't think that's the real world, when I submit research proposals, they go through filters that automatically measure all this stuff, your margins, your page counts, and if it doesn't pass that, the proposal doesn't even get submitted. It gets bounced back to you. And that could be a proposal that we spent $1 million developing on. I've seen $1 million proposals get thrown out for reasons like that. I've seen $400 million proposals get thrown out for reasons like that. When a sponsor, when a funder or your boss says 150 to 200 words, they mean it. Or they will say about. If they don't say about. So, 150, 200 words. Discuss what you will do, how you'll do it, and why this is important. When I read that abstract, I have to be interested. I have to be motivated to look more into this project. It should say contain some numerical or quantitative goals. Something like, you know, we're going to improve efficiency by 25%. I don't want to just see lots of words because words can mean anything. We're going to build something that's really good, or we're going to build something that's better than the last thing. That doesn't mean anything in the engineering world. Tell me with numbers. And discuss what's unique about your contribution and the implications of success. Those are the basic things I think should be in an abstract. Here's an example. It's actually longer than 200 words, but when this was written, right, so you don't have to read it. When this was written, it was I didn't have that constraint. And I don't know, I would probably give this a B if I was grading it. It's not bad. It was by a pretty good project, but it could be better. But there's an example, and we'll, over the week, I'll distribute a few more examples, but you've talked about this in your technical writing course also, how to write abstracts. You've had that, been exposed to that before. And we'll iterate over the semester on all these things to get them just right. But I want your first draft of an abstract. Now, you've already sent me one at the beginning of the semester, but I can tell you most of those were pretty general. They didn't really give me a good sense of what you were specifically going to do. So now we have to start talking about what you're specifically going to do. So we're at the 50-minute point. Now, I've noticed the scheduling of this course has been a little strange because I think in past semesters this course has been like an hour and 15 minutes or something for the lectures. But since it's one credit hour, it should be, I think, just like an hour lecture. So we'll try to keep things to 50 minutes. But let me just quickly, let's work through a quick example to try to make all this a little more concrete. And then we'll be done. So in a few, just give me a couple more, 5 more minutes maybe. So let's pick a concept and turn it into a senior design project. So give me some ideas. And it can't be anything that people are already doing. Just a general kind of thing you might like to build or something you might like to be involved in. Subways? Okay. Restaurants or transportation? Subway system? Regional rail. We actually have a faculty member working on a way to improve the regional rail system here. There was another quest. There was another.
Design a roadway to connect to existing roadways.
Roadways. Roadways are interesting because they involve a lot of different constraints, right? So let's talk about roadways quickly because that, I think, is a nice example of how cost plays into things. So when you're trying, let's say what Philadelphia is lacking is like a north-south expressway, right? Does anyone live on? I live in Elkins Park. Anyone live like straight north, and you try to get downtown? It's like you just have to go through all these stoplights, right? So we're going to build a north-south toll expressway for Philadelphia.
Isn't that the 95?
But that's like east or west, right?
Make a C.
Yeah, well, that's, you know. What?
Parallel to Lake Broad.
Yeah, let's say we're going to try to go down Broad Street. With like, well, that's, we're going to get into that, right? Well, they actually tried this in a town I grew up in, Chicago. They wanted to build something along one of the major streets and actually talked about turning the street into an expressway and all this, and then they talked about putting an expressway above the street. So if we were to build an expressway down Broad Street, what are some of the issues, what are some of the constraints that we're going to be faced with? Space. Tell me about space. Okay, well, we'll build it 40 feet up in the air where there's plenty of space.
You still need entrance and exit.
Okay, so we'll build ramps.
Where? The residence. It's residential.
What?
Previously on property.
So what's going to be probably the dominant design constraint or feasibility issue with our Broad Street expressway? Come on, what do you think about as taxpayers? It can be built. I guarantee you I could build a Broad Street expressway, but what's going to prevent it?
Money.
Why?
It's going to be expensive.
It's going to be expensive because to deal with all these good issues you all brought up, it's going to be very, very expensive.
You can't really do that, though, because if you build an expressway 40 feet up or something like that, you're taking sunlight away from certain buildings, and isn't there like a required minimum amount of sunlight?
So this is an environmental impact, right?
Maybe.
When I lived in Dallas, they actually talked about double-decking the LBJ Expressway. It was already 12 lanes wide, and they wanted to double-deck it with another 12 lanes, and they actually got into issues like this. There's also issues of pollution. What about structural issues, though? One of the interesting things about roads is it's always a compromise between how much money you want to spend and how long you want the road to last. A lot of these roads you find that buckle and have to be resurfaced every year, often that could have been prevented if they were willing to spend enough money to provide a proper foundation for that road. But they always cut corners on the foundation. In the town I lived in Mississippi, we actually went through this. They resurfaced a road, and I was talking to the road engineers at the time, And the engineers, the civil engineers, told them they needed to put like 3 feet of crushed rock or something as a base at a cost that was like 10 times what they could afford to spend on the road. So they chose not to do that. And within a couple years of building this road, the road was buckling again because the ground there is so unstable. And the civil engineers were furious because they told them, if you build it this way, it won't last more than a few years. So you face those kinds of trade-offs with roads. You can't just design them. It's always designed to cost. It's always designed to environmental impacts. There's always space, property, acquisition. There's a lot of legal issues associated with acquiring properties in urban environments. What about the road, the technology itself, the composition of the road? What are some of the things that are going to go into that? Suppose that, for example, you're going to build this on the ground versus you're going to build my suspended highway up 40 feet up in the air. Which is harder to do? Why?
Because you've got to worry about the ground settling and stuff. The weight.
If the ground can handle the weight of the traffic.
But that's sort of a wash. I mean, I don't know a lot about road building, but I think that's sort of a wash whether you build the road on the ground or whether you suspend it. The total weight's going to be about the same, give or take, you know, 25%. But why do so many roads that are built above ground, whatever you call them, elevated, why do so many of those fail? Where are civil engineers? They should know this stuff. The what? So what happens when you build metal structure and you put a lot of concrete around it?
Expansion,
contraction, right? And what happens in an area like Philadelphia where you go through the four seasons and you have freezing weather, you have water that seeps inside the concrete and freezes, all this kind of nasty stuff. You also have interfaces between two pieces of metal which tend to move. So, you know, they always have these problems with it, the joints and all that stuff. So there's a lot of technical issues with building an elevated expressway. They used to be really popular so many of them have become such maintenance nightmares they're really expensive. So when a road is a good example of, you're almost always constrained by the customer to do things a certain way. You're never allowed to just design the world's best road possible. And that's why a lot of the roads you see that fail probably fail not because they did a bad job, but because the design constraints they settled on and the compromises they made were maybe not the best for that particular application. And it's hard to predict that sometimes, especially if you don't know how the soil is going to behave over long periods of time. There was a section of a road in Dallas where I lived where the ground was really unstable, and every few years they resurfaced that, tried all sorts of different technologies, but you'd go on that expressway, and when you'd hit that part, you'd feel the dip, because there was this one section, it was like marshland, and they just could never find the right kind of technology to build that span of the road other than just lots of asphalt. Okay, so any questions? The students who are not involved in projects absolutely need to get on board with your project, get the information to me early this week, because by Friday I'll pull the trigger and drop you from the course.
So when do I have to submit this abstract?
The abstract's due 5 p.m. Friday. That'll be generally when our things are due.
Friday.
This coming Friday. Right? It was on the syllabus.
It said next Friday.
This coming Friday. Yeah, but it was on the syllabus. We can do that. I'm trying to give you like a couple weeks notice on these dates.
So is it due on Friday or on Monday?
Do we want it due dates 8 a.m. Monday? Does anybody not want an 8 a.m. Monday due date? All right, we'll make the due dates 8 a.m. Monday. It's all actually a wash because eventually you have so many things in the queue going that you'll still,
So like all these, you're saying it's on the syllabus, so like
like all the assignments are already on there.
I'm trying to get them out there.
So we don't have to wait for the class.
No. You should always be, you know, I'll try to through email kind of keep you updated.
Okay.
I put the first two out a couple weeks ago, or like last week when I put up the syllabus. And I'll put a few more out today or tomorrow. I do expect you to be meeting as teams outside of class on a regular basis each week. And you should also be meeting with your project advisors. If you're not meeting with your project advisors weekly, that's unacceptable. So go tell your project advisors that, you know, they need to schedule weekly meeting times with you.